Saturday, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You're listening to the news. My name's T.C. Dowell. And with me on the air is Lehi. Lehi, how are you doing today, my man?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Not bad. Not bad at all. Just got done having a little bit of lunch. Actually still sitting here watching my five-year-old struggle to get his lunch down.
Right on.
Keep going, son.
Say what?
Anyway, talking to the kid. So what's going on with you, man?
Just a busy week trying to get regular type work done. So I got a little bit of time to relax this weekend. I got some more work to do, but I'll have more time for myself, maybe do some writing, some planning, that kind of thing. Well, there's one thing I did that I really enjoyed on Thanksgiving or whatever. I spent most of the day sitting on my computer trying to learn Linux bash shell commands. And so I downloaded this program called Fink that you can get a bunch of different Linux programs on. You can run them on your Mac using the terminal app.
Right on. So you ended up playing in that, I'll take it.
Yeah. I think it's just good. Well, first of all, it's just good to know that kind of stuff anyway. I mean, it's the freaking 21st century. If I don't know how to use a computer proficiently, I mean, sure, maybe I know better than like the average person how to use a damn computer, but, it's about time to learn some good stuff.
Right on. Right. Well, that starts somewhere. I found necessity is the best instructor myself personally, so.
Yeah, well, there are other reasons I went into all that, but I'm not going to give the details on that here.
Right, of course not. So anyway, you didn't have a chance to really read our PDF. As a matter of fact, you were hitting me up this morning for it. So
yeah, I was skimming over it, checking out some of it. I did go to Chapter 3 after looking at it was kind of interesting how it was talking about how Iran actually had, back in the day before the Muslims took over, they had an Eastern system, which included right-hand and left-hand practices. And it was saying that the root of European pagan culture came from that area when people migrated west.
Right. Well, the truth be told, man, Iran still to this day has its Kurdic practices. The Kurds, which are what you're referring to, practice more of what you might consider to be closer to Orthodox Hindu religion than it would be actual Muslim belief systems. But one of the things that I found most interesting in how all this stuff kind of spun together to come out that we've been doing, talking about on this show lately, is the early ideas of Gnostic Christianity. That's actually where you'll see a lot of these different aspects of the systems kind of begin to manifest, and that's kind of why I was tackling the origin of Christianity with Jason King a little bit, and why we then, after that, went into Evola and kind of took a look there at the connection of East to West. So,
yep.
I don't necessarily think that Christianity and the Muslim culture really did much to the core concepts themselves in terms of damage, but what we do see is that they changed form in order to preserve the ideas that were in there. Real quick, before we get too far along here, the book that we're talking about right now is Stephen Flowers' Lords of the Left-Hand Path is the title?
Yep, that's the one.
Yeah. Now, this book is actually not a new book. About a year and a half ago, Dark Fool and King Calamari both started talking about this book again like it was, you know, the latest news. And I, of course, was like, man, that sounds really familiar. So I downloaded the PDF around that time. And as I started rereading it, I realized that I had read this book once before in the late 90s.
Yeah, did it come out in 89?
It actually came out in 97 was when this book was actually published. But the author does state in the first, in the introduction, does state that he was done actually writing this book by 1982. But I guess there were some things that hadn't quite come together or whatever, and so he didn't actually put it out until later after he'd done all his fact-checking and stuff, so...
Right, yeah, publishing a book is a bitch, to say the least.
Right on. So, the first two chapters in this book are basically just a re-expoundation of what we fished out in our exploration of Julia Savola's work, The Yoga of Power. So I thought that as a good kind of starting point, we would talk about Chapter 3. I know you haven't really had much of a chance to read it, and that's okay, because I really just want to kind of skim over the context of it anyways and encourage people to pick up the PDF or the actual book and read it for themselves instead of somehow making this like Sunday school class or a book club. This is more like a perusing of the concepts presented.
Yeah, so, the evolution of the ideas in their forms.
Right. I think the most notable thing in Chapter 3 immediately is within the first paragraph. And what he basically does is he expresses that with varying degrees of accuracy, European culture, meaning Western culture, and began using the phrase left-hand path kind of synonymously with Satanism. You could say left-hand path and you could say Satanism, and a lot of people would connect the two as being, equivalents. And he states that that's not necessarily the case.
Right, it's only...
Accuracy. Go for it.
Sorry, I keep interrupting you, but I was going to say, it's only accurate in the sense that Satanism is antinomian or counter-current to Judeo-Christian beliefs. So it's only left-hand path as far as that's concerned, because left-hand path takes many forms, and that just happens to be the one people are most familiar with because Christianity is so prevalent.
Well... Here's the thing, and this has some variance in terms of its actual truthfulness, so don't take this as being like the whole of the law or anything like that, but in my mind, in its essence, Satanism is pure left-hand path in its practice, and so that in itself is what the distinction is. You can take things like dark paganism or Thelema, and you can practice them with the left-hand path aspect, but ultimately the entirety of its system is, bipolar. And the author kind of expresses that throughout this particular text. So, when you think about Crowley's Thelema, do you think of evil, or do you think of good, or do you think of dancing in between?
I think there's two poles.
Yeah, it dances in between in ways. It's how do I explain this? A lot of the stuff that Crowley espoused was antinomian, and at the same point, a lot of the stuff that he espoused was very orthodox. So this is just kind of this polemic, dance or discourse that kind of arises just in the work of Crowley alone. But I really, I think is interesting when you take a look at this particular book, the characters in which the author Flowers actually draws from is a broad range of different sources that he's taking from. He's taking from Carl Jung, he's taking from Blavatsky, he's taking from Julia Savola. As a matter of fact, what's interesting is this book here is the book that actually introduced me to the author, Julia Savola. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah, so it's kind of a connection because he talks a little bit about Avola's discoveries, and he accepts the actual magnitude of, scholarly work that's implied within Avola's text, The Yoga of Power. But anyway, to kind of wrap back to what I was getting at, what he's expressing here by it being both accurate and inaccurate in terms of Satanism being left-hand path is maybe a little different than what I proposed a few minutes ago. But the path in specific that he's talking about, he agrees would have a great deal of sympathy for the devil. And he actually kind of makes a reference to the Gnostic Christianity right immediately off the back, because there were some that actually sympathized with Satan. And so it's interesting in that aspect, because here you have people who claim to be holy right-hand path, and yet they have this resonance or this sympathy for the countercurrent of what they believe. It kind of provides a different structure, and it takes away that dichotomy that we've been, laboring over the past few shows to establish and then knock down. Here's the perfect example of how it's really an illusionary dichotomy that we have presenting itself on these Gnostic sects that he's referring to.
I had a thought, though. Knowing that about the Gnostics, would that imply that some of the first people that could be identified as Satanists were indeed Gnostics, like in a more traditional sense?
And I'm trying to remember the name of this cult. There was a cult in Toledo, Ohio, that came up sometime in, I think, the 30s or 40s. Our Lady something or another. If somebody knows what the name of it is, chime in here, because off the top of my head it's not ringing in. But the deal with them is that they, in fact, themselves were the original Satanists, the first Satanists. That they were the first Americanized Western Satanists, but they did it in the form of a cult rather than as orthodoxy, if I can say that right, a heterodox orthodoxy, like LeVay's sometime just shortly after manifested. That's always been the very curious principle about the Church of Satan, the man. Satan in himself stands for the ultimate authority of the individual, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I picture this romanticized version of this angel who's in shackles, and he's being told by this glowing throne in front of him to take a knee and bow, and not just bow to this God, but bow to man, which stands beside him. And he says, you know what? Fuck you. I'm better than them.
And kind of a Promethean theme.
What's that?
It's a Promethean theme.
Yeah. Yeah, that's precisely. So in my mind, this is, this is an allegorical equivalent to what Satanism itself really represents. It is that ultimate self-authority, ultimate self-governing, to the point of complete defiance to anything that tries to impose its will upon you. So,
right.
I mean, that that in itself kind of changes the structure of things when you're looking at LaVey making, well, a church.
Yeah, his exoteric form just seems counterintuitive with the essence of Satan.
And it does. And so here's the thing. Now, I read LaVey's works, and I always catch the Joker aspect, the trickster aspect of LaVey's work. He was very much the type of guy that believed the devil had a good sense of humor. I don't know if you ever saw that early interview that he does, and I can't remember who the interviewer was, but it was posted on the front page of Sin for a little while. This guy, through the whole show, is just lambasting him with as many, you know, insults to his intellect and his persona as is possible, and he's just kind of taking it tongue-in-cheek, chuckling, and spinning the joke in his own way. There's a particular instance that I can think of where they're talking about his ring, and the guy asks him if it came out of a bubblegum machine. And he looks at him and says, "This? No, this is a powerful magic ring. Little children rub it and their wishes come true." And he then says, "Little children go around you?" And he says, "Of course, of course." So, you know, the joke is kind of on this guy now, because this guy wants to demonize him, and LaVey is just owning he's just owning that demonic essence, and in doing that, he's kind of creating a psychological trump with his interviewer. So I mean, that aspect now points back to the Church of Satan, and the Church of Satan being what I would say is LaVey's biggest prank. I mean, imagine what could be more hilarious than trapping up all of these sycophantic type people who just want to cling to the name of Satan because it's cool, and trapping them up, and not only trapping them up, but getting them to financially commit to it, to contribute to it themselves. I mean, it would be the complete mockery of orthodoxy.
He's pretty much found a way to box them all up. All the people that he would speak against, he was able to put them all in a room with the same label. That's just hilarious.
Exactly. And so now when you take it in that context, you wonder, did Satan chuckle on his way out?
Probably did. Like a joke on you.
I would say he probably... Here we go. Oh, you found it. Our Lady Indoor Coven. Yeah, you found it.
The Ophite Cultus Satanus. So the Ophites are that Gnostic group.
Yeah. That's who I'm talking about. They were in fact the first Satanists in the American tradition. And they relied heavily upon these Gnostic documents that I'm talking about. So you see that this kind of pokes a big hole in the idea that LaVey even coined the term Satanist.
Well, of course. Like, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, the term Satan to begin with is Hebrew anyway. So that obviously
right.
predates him, so... But yeah, the Ophites existed back when and have sympathy for the devil, so to speak, and engaged in antinomian behavior, then yeah, you might as well call them Satanists. I mean, what else could they be?
Right. Well, then the whole thing of this here, and what Flowers actually is pointing to in the very first two chapters of this book is that... you know, the left-hand path and the practices associated with it, the orthodox or heterodox practical material aspect, it was already existing in the indigenous practices in the West prior to the arrival of Christianity. So they existed regardless of having a title for being the adversary or not. They were, in fact, the enemy. not by their own choice, but by the choices made of the people who were adopting this exotic Eastern religion that was coming about at the time.
Right. So when Christianity came around, the funny thing is that, you know, you had in the pagan cultures in Europe, you had the you had left-hand and right-hand path practices, and they were both accepted in those societies. But when Christianity came around, they said that both were evil, and so to survive, they had to take on new forms because it kind of got confusing.
Right. And that's and what they did was kind of clever in that they just kind of they kept the things that people seem to be most attached to, you know, particular holidays, particular festivals, and stuff like that. They kept those things. And they just kind of mutated them into these other concepts. And I think that that in itself is kind of, it's noteworthy on their part. I mean, that's certainly one way to get shit done. You know, it's easy to be a wolf among sheep if you have sheep's clothing on.
You know what's kind of interesting? That's kind of a parallel to this, and it has to do with Gnosticism. When I was reading about Gnosticism, when you had the literalist church versus the... hold on a second, my God. Sorry about that. My niece was trying to talk to me. But anyway, so you had the traditional church, not traditional, the literalist church and the Gnostics. What you had, because the Gnostics were an esoteric tradition, what you had was the Gnostics accepted the literalist view as well as their own esoteric view. So they performed in the same exoteric rituals and even went to church with all the literalists. So in a way, they were able to hide amongst the sheep.
Right. Well, it wasn't really hiding amongst the sheep. It was back in those times, what was important really was your own praxis, your own deeds. It didn't matter which form of religiousness you practiced. Everybody practiced religiousness. It kind of reminds me of that and I can't remember the name of that movie with Keanu Reeves in it and the Tetragrammaton, and it's slipping me at this point in time.
There was Ninth Gate, was that it?
Equilibrium. That.
I don't think I've seen that one.
You're right. Equilibrium. That was Christian Bale, not Keanu Reeves. It's the same dude, different body, that's all. But anyhow, in that movie, they all kind of practice this a certain set of personal behaviors, and it's manifested in one particular religion, but that religion's kind of set up to encompass all of the behaviors as long as they're absent this feeling or feelings in general. It's kind of a cool movie, something to check out. Another movie I'm actually thinking about now, I'm trying to remember what the hell the name of this one is. There's another movie out there where the important thing is that everybody practices a religion. It doesn't matter what the religion is. So if you didn't have a religion, then you're the heterodox.
Kind of sounds like real life right now.
Yeah, and that's kind of how real life has manifested. I think it's neat to see these kinds of movies appearing, because their stories are very much related to what's going on in modern culture, at least in terms of the depth of its own memoplexus. So, anyway, I can't remember what the hell the name of that movie is either, but I'm thinking it's either V or something else. It's not coming to me. Anyway, I think we should move on here, because otherwise I'm going to get myself locked up trying to remember the name of a goddamn movie. So the next part in chapter 3 that he gets into is talking about pagan roots in Europe. And he kind of says around 4000 BC, the true root of Western culture was based in Celtic, Italic, Germanic, Slavic, or Hellenic languages. Their cultures were based in those common different religious practices, and their mythologies and religious systems kind of were related ultimately from one origin. And he doesn't really get into the exacts of how he draws it back to the Indo-Iranian tradition, but that's what you were making mention of in the very beginning of this, was that it had all kind of come out of this Kurdish practice.
Well, didn't he have earlier in the book, didn't he talk about the Zoroastrians? They came to be?
He did talk about that, yes. But again, he's not really drawing a full connection here. He's just kind of implying, and I think that's fine, because the actual, to sit and dwell on every little detail of what arose during that point in time and this progression would kind of negate the whole point of the examination of it, period, which the examination of it should point to the fact that we progress, we continue to develop, that these ideas are ever present, and they just take new forms on a constant basis. And I think that's really kind of the overall point of everything. What he notes about the Indo-European cosmology that makes it different from its Hindu equal at that time is that this kind of puts forth this idea of divine order, and that that this is that top, where the top-down sphere that Dan's always talking about kind of begins to take its precedence.
You mean like his post about the upward and downward spirals?
Well, Dan talks about it often, and a lot of his different posts and stuff like that. He will go and present this bottom-up dichotomy in lieu of a top-down dichotomy. And what he's talking about is starting at the base or the core of the individual and working yourself outward, versus starting at the divine, the absolute, and working yourself downward into individuals. When you look at it from that perspective, what you see is one champagne glass sitting on top of a tower of tiers of champagne glasses, and someone's just standing there pouring the champagne up into that top glass, and it's filtering down through the pyramid of glasses. And what this ultimately means is that the bottom glass can never really get all that is offered by the bottle being poured.
Right. So with all these different, with all these different forms, they have this hierarchy in society that reflects this divine stratification, you could say.
Right. And so, of course, the idea was that the human soul, or the psyche, quote-unquote, is a gift given to us by the gods, and that social orderings are actually a pantheistic representation or manifestation of this particular gift. So, that comes exactly to the ideas that we're talking about this last show when we were talking about monism versus pantheism.
Right.
It's still an ism. Anyway, I'm kind of skimming through here. I know you didn't get a chance to really read this, so. While I'm thinking about this, I'd like a little bit of feedback in the chat room. If people are interested in getting a copy of this PDF and can't find it, if they'd like me to do the same thing I did with the other one and upload it on the Go to Mendez site.
Yeah, it used to be on Mendez, but that link is broken because it was on fearthebeast.com.
Right, right, yeah, so I have to upload it by itself. Yeah, that makes sense. I was the one who offered it originally, so.
So it's the same copy.
What's that?
So it's the same copy, pretty much.
Yeah, it's the exact same copy. What I find fascinating is he seems to kind of, in this chapter, he seems to kind of focus directly on the Mediterranean region. So when we start talking here, he starts talking in terms of, I don't know, the Hellenic period, the Balkans, and Italian peninsula, is that area in there. And what we kind of come up with then is the rising of the Age of Homer, or the modern philosopher, as I like to call them.
And then doesn't it evolve into Platoism?
Into what?
Into Plato, like his work?
Plato, yes, of course. Being that Plato, in my opinion, was the father of Western thought, and it, of course, kind of all bleeds back to him. I mean, he's kind of the guy who said, oh, wait a minute, you know, there's this thing that's inside of us, and it helps us make these decisions, and it gives us this the ability to make choices, and it presents us with the ability to create these abstracts in our mind.
There was a dichotomy between the objective and the subjective universe. And I think that's what you're talking about with the psyche or soul, as some people would put it. Or even you can call it the acausal as another word.
Right on. Yeah, so once again, that's an interesting parallel that I think is worth kind of pointing to, the fact that this idea keeps reappearing in Western practices. Causal, acausal. It's really funny because I've sat and listened to our past few shows on Hinduism and more specifically on the Yoga of Power, talking about Shaktiism, and I wonder, because of the lens that we view it from, how different we really perceive what's being presented to us. Like, for instance, we're discussing right now causal, acausal. Now, that aspect was obviously there with Shiva and Shakti, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. So, but the question is, did they view it that same way?
That's a good question. I haven't immersed myself in those cultures, so it's kind of hard to say.
I mean, what comes to my mind then is that maybe this abstraction itself is one that needs to be consciously labored in a different way. I don't want to say against, because you might labor against it for a bit, and then you might embrace it and see what else, you know, comes about it. But could you imagine trying to think of things not in a causal, acausal form, but in like a supra-causal form?
I don't know. That sounds interesting.
I mean, imagine if everything was supra-causal, meaning sometimes it had life, sometimes it didn't. So how does that change the perspective of the things that we've discussed?
Wait, what was the word you used? Supra-causal?
Supra-causal.
Oh, yes. Supra. And what do you mean by
like
that exactly?
Something might be held in a superposition.
You mean like an outer layer?
I mean like, rather than looking at them as their poles, their polar vectorization, you know, causal, acausal, we look at them as sometimes causal, sometimes acausal, sometimes acausal and causal, and sometimes just strictly I don't know, neither. And what we come up with is something completely different in terms of an idea. You know, I mean, I guess the analogy that I would use to describe it is I would point to a car, and I would say the car is the supracausal. Sometimes it's sitting still, and there's no life or motion to it. There's no movement. There's nothing, and it's just sitting there. But there are times when the engine is running, and the tires are rolling, and the wheels are turning, and it's going one direction or the other, forwards or backwards, and you begin to see what I'm talking about, in that we're still describing the same thing, and we're still talking. Go for it.
You're talking about the same thing in a different way, using different terms. I think that's what you're saying, right?
Okay.
Instead of looking at through the same lens that we were before, try to find a different point of view of it.
Yeah, that's precisely it. Is creating that different point of view, realizing that though at this moment we're talking about the fist that's punching, the right foot is sitting completely still. There's no life in it. As the mouth is talking, the leg on the right is shaking, and there's different manifestations of the same thing occurring at the exact same time.
Right, I'm not sure where we're going with this exactly. It's very highly abstract.
The idea is that it is completely abstract. There's not really a direction to go with it. It was just kind of a recognition of the fact that, I wonder if we view these polemic dichotomies the same when we're exploring them as they did in their native culture.
Oh, I see. I think I see what you mean. Like, we're all talking about a car, but they might be talking about right-hand turns or speeding through red lights, and we might be talking about something else, like backing up the car.
Right. One is describing the construction of the car. The other is describing its behavior. You see?
Yeah. And underlying all these different forms is the same idea. But it'd be interesting to see how they viewed it from their culture.
Right. Agreed. So, what becomes really interesting to me is that we begin during this Hellenic period that's being described in this third chapter, we begin to see the mixing of these two different schools happening, simply because the Greeks at that time were accomplished enough sailors or seamen that they were able to travel to places that were far away from them at that point in time.
Like the Egyptian cultures and whatnot.
Right.
On the other side of the Mediterranean.
Right.
So I knew that
so
the Hellenic
were,
schools had an influence on Judaism, didn't they?
Pardon me?
Didn't they have an effect on Judaism?
Yeah, they certainly did. That's where you get the Gnostic traditions from.
Yeah, because my thought was that the Hellenic tradition. Well, I know the mystery religions were pretty popular back then, and all the different. In different indigenous religions or whatever, in different forms, and that Judaism was a little bit harder to assimilate into the same esoteric school of thought, whatever, because they didn't have the same pantheon that all the other religions had, which is where we come into problems with the literalist Christian church, because they're... I don't know if I should go into much about this. I know that JK is supposed to be talking about the origins of Christianity. He might have a a better idea of how it went down because he actually studied this.
Right on. Right on. So, in the next part of this chapter, Flowers starts to talk about Prometheus and Pandora, and he starts to kind of draw some connections between Jehovah and Prometheus. And he says very specifically that Prometheus seems to be, borrowed from the Middle East. The concept of Prometheus is borrowed from the Middle East, and that it's talking specifically about Jehovah, which, in kind of a side note of contrast on that, it makes me kind of chuckle when I think about all the good doers or
the Luciferians.
Exactly.
Oh, no, that's been exactly. A common thing, like, when we were over at LRS, you know. The idea, and when we're trying to talk about LHP with them, because I guess they don't really get it, we're trying to talk about what would Prometheus do. I mean, he was countercurrent. He did go against the laws of the gods, and he was punished for it. And
right.
So,
yeah.
Which, that's the angle you got to talk to them about it, but they were still adverse to the idea of being antinomian. They don't seem to understand their own mythologies.
But I don't think they were necessarily antithetic to it. I think, in fact, that it kind of taught a level of wisdom where it showed if you push too hard, this is what happened. But this is the other things that came out of it. You know, it was a cause plus effect kind of thing.
Right.
But, I just thought that was kind of an interesting parallel, and I sat here and thought about the fact that our buddy Mayboner is, he's busy pushing the Prometheus idea right now.
He had that Promethean network idea. But it makes me wonder how much he really understands the implications.
Right. I think that he understands the aspects of it that he wants to. Like he's pro-egalitarian, and that's something that's definitely found in the Promethean legend, is that egalitarian idea that there should be some kind of harmony between the gods and humanity.
Right, and they were talking about, they were talking about Hesiod. Was he the one that was pro-egalitarian? Like, he was saying that before the gods and man were, they're buddy-buddy, and they shared fire and all that good stuff, and Prometheus is the bad guy, rather than a benefactor of man. So they wanted to hail back to the days of when God and men were together in unanimity, which is a right-hand path viewpoint. But he was also talking about later how other people really did view Prometheus as kind of a hero or benefactor, or even maybe you could say the creator, even though the myth of Prometheus making men out of clay was borrowed from other sources because of some misunderstandings.
Right. Well, what I think ultimately that this can be boiled down to when you're looking at it in a very simple context is anyone who has enabled or given a higher ability to man is ultimately deemed as being heterodox or being antinomian. That when you take something, or you give man the ability to do something more and increase his power, you're somehow taking power away from the divinity. And I think that in itself is kind of, like I said, it's the core concept here that's being expressed.
Right, it's that bottom glass filling itself with the, regardless of what the top-down structure says. I'm going to fill my own glass to be like the glass on top.
And you see a complete inversion of that idea when you look at the legend of Jesus Christ. He came to us to give us some kind of a gift, to give us the ability to move beyond this certain point. And as a side factor of it, the man in him had to die.
Yeah, it is kind of weird how they reverse it like that. But isn't that how it was with the mystery religions too? The Messiah figure had to die.
As far as I know, now I'm not the world's foremost scholar on these things or whatever. I've done some reading, but I wouldn't claim any kind of total authority here. However, I would say that does seem to be my understanding as well. So
it kind of makes me wonder. How influenced the mystery religions are. Oh, I guess it gets to that later, doesn't it? With the mystery religions, how if they had right hand and left hand practices in their esoteric tradition?
Yeah, they did, and that's the whole thing, is that these practices were not separate. That you could dedicate yourself to one particular school, but more so than not, it was part of the total learning experience, that you would start at one end of the path and walk your way to the other end of the path. And in the process of doing that, you would gain a few feet in the forward direction. Only if you get to the end of the path, so to speak, and turn around and do it all back over again. I mean, you see that when you see people talking about, the different Vedas. They talk about them, and then they talk about the fact that it kind of circles back. It's suggested when we discuss the Incans and their calendars. When we describe anything in an aeonic manner, the idea that the aeon will circle again or come back again is present.
Kind of like the Ouroboros, or however the hell you say it.
Yes, it's precisely where that idea is embedded, the serpent. We see it in our zodiac, we see it in the Chinese zodiac, we see this example reappearing and rehappening and reappearing. It's funny, any story that starts within the beginning always has the end. And so, in the beginning, there was the end. If there's a beginning, there's an end, and that cycle kind of keeps going forward. If there's an end,
kind of sounds
beginning.
Like samsara.
It sounds similar to it, yes. But again, we're talking about an overarching concept, we're not specific, and its manifestation or nature. You can take this concept and you can look at it a couple of different ways. Have you ever seen a movie where the very first scene was the very last scene of the movie?
Yes, Memento.
Memento, there's a good example. Now, have you seen a movie where the beginning was in the beginning and the end was in the end?
Oh, a lot of movies are like that.
All right. Have you seen a movie where you start in the middle? And
yes, aren't Tarantino's movies do that, like a Pulp Fiction?
Hey, this is all the same cycle being described. It's just being described from a different aspect or a different starting point. You draw that line, and the line can go infinitely. From one end to the other, it can continue to go into this big circle, right? I mean, theoretically, that line will go forever. Yeah, it's fine. You take a pencil and you just kind of move your hand and lay it down right in that line wherever you feel like it, and there's your start.
Yeah, and you see this thing continue with these different cultures as it progresses from the east to west. Or I guess as they say, north to south. They try to, the guy's talking about how the West is really the North, and the South is I guess, is the East. Kind of, I guess, Christianity was associated with the South, and what we consider Eastern traditions are from the North. But anyway, the point is that it's evolving throughout these different cultures as they come into contact with other cultures, and they adopt those same ideas, and it takes different forms.
Right. Well, we're all pretty familiar with the movie Clash of the Titans, right?
I'm familiar with that. I've actually seen it.
You haven't seen either the old version or the new?
No. I might have seen the older one when I was a kid, but I don't remember it. I knew it was claymation, but that's about it.
Right. Well, the whole thing with this here is, well, there's kind of like this bet put out, and this is not the exact context of the story, but it's more my perception of what's going on. And the bet is that, you know, that gods are better than man, who's, you know, well, they've forsaken these gods. And, you know, that one says, well, I can make them pay for it, and they all kind of agree upon that, but there's that one god, Zeus, in this particular story, who is silently kind of championing mankind. And so he, you know, does these little extra favors for mankind. And in doing this, he's kind of created himself as being the devil of the Godhead. So it's kind of a fascinating thing when you look at it through that aspect, that, you know, these gods all agreed that they wanted man destroyed and taught a lesson because, well, man doesn't revere them like they used to. And at the same point, the head god, who's, you know, in public agreed to this, is practicing a subversive tactic, and he's kind of silently rooting for his quote-unquote proverbial child, so...
Yeah, that sounds like the idea of the serpent giving, you know, I guess the original, like, the Christian idea of the Garden of Eden about the serpent giving the fruit of the tree, from the tree of knowledge to Adam and Eve.
Right on.
But I guess the difference...
Please, go ahead.
I was saying the difference is, I guess, how they told the story, whereas the serpent is not God himself, but I guess you're saying... Clash of Titans, it was Zeus, but whatever.
Well, ultimately, if you really look at it, you know, really step back and look at it, let's just talk about the myth of Garden of Eden, since we got about 6 minutes left, and we're not going to get too much further into what we're talking about. But if you look at the story of the Garden of Eden, and you think about the implied things that are there, the first thing that's implied is that God created everything, all of that stuff, right?
Right.
From the two trees to the garden to man to woman to the serpent, that they're all creations of God.
Knowing that they would do that.
Absolutely. Happen to know. I mean, to be God, the way that it's implied in the story, he knew that the whole thing would come down the way that it did. So is the serpent really, in spite of God, talking even to biting off of that tree, or is it because of God?
Well, I guess he did set it all in motion, so it is kind of his plan.
Right. So what we then come to is this idea of rooting silently for the underdog.
And it keeps things in motion.
Keeping things in motion, exactly. So the concepts there are both similar. They're both the same in their expression, and they're both kind of teaching you the same lesson, at least on one layer.
Right, so left-hand and right hand are part of the same system, just different approaches.
Right. Just different approaches, that's right. And ultimately, for anything to really come about, it can't be either left, right, or middle. or no path even at that. You know, if it's to come out new. I mean, Buddhism, what is Buddhism? It's
a no-hand
path.
It's
the path of nothing. Right, it's the path of nothing. Hinduism is the path between, or all paths. And it is left hand, right hand. So we see another fractal, another manifestation, another division happening, another level of realization.
You know, what's interesting, this is making me think about is, starting with the Buddhism thing, it's no hand path, but when I was reading this book, it was talking about how when Buddhism came around, it was heretical to Hinduism. So basically, like, even if it is no hand path in its axiomatic and practice, but what I'm trying to say is, and based on what you're saying, is there are different ways of viewing it. So one person's path, it may look vastly different than somebody else's.
Right. Right, but ultimately it's all the same path. Your path, your own path. Not meaning that my path and yours are the same at all, but rather meaning that they are the same because it is my path and it is your path.
They're both paths.
Right. And that is it in context of it. We've got just about 2 minutes left here, man. I think we're going to do a little more flowers next week. Then after that, I think it's time to kind of begin to build more into Eliphas Levi, Madame Blavatsky, you know, the early, again, Age of Renaissance.
Yeah, Blavatsky is one I want to look into. I'm downloading like a lot of left-hand path literature, but I think Blavatsky is in there, so that would be a good one to go into. What was the other one you said that I kind of cut you off?
Levi.
Levi, gotcha.
Yeah, all right. On that, man, thanks for another great show, dude, and we'll go ahead and roll this outro and get the hell out of here.
Oh, no, let's give ourselves drop some links. So you check out eminentmind.info, check out entropicmindem.com, check out oozradio.wordpress.com, and check out standardnational.com, check out autodiabolic.wordpress.com, check out interrogus.wordpress.com, and check out orderofnineangles.net.
Big no. All right. Sounds good, man.
All right. Have a good one.
Later.